by Hayek of this chapter, where it talks about the ingredients that led to totalitarianism. And this is in his day. What are the ingredients? Increasing veneration for the state, the admiration of power and for bigness for bigness's sake, the enthusiasm for the planning of everything, and the inability to leave anything to the simple power of organic growth. And so this is sort of a return to his discussion of the spontaneous order of markets, where this idea was just forgotten, and the idea was accepted by a lot of people that everything has to be planned by government bureaucrats. How could we ever get shoes or milk or anything else that was not the government planning it for us, in other words? Okay. And so he's talking about the ingredients of tyranny, of totalitarianism. And they all sound awfully familiar to today's world. And then he goes into a discussion of World War I and how he saw it as a major breaking point in the movement toward totalitarianism. And by the way, if you do have a chance to look at the speech by Robert Higgs that is on Mises.org today, which Cam has just provided a link to, one of the things he said at the Mises Institute last week was that he thinks that the United States is very, very close to being a totalitarian state right now. So in Higgs's opinion, we're almost at the end of the road to serfdom. But here's what Hayek says from a historical perspective, writing in 1943. He's speaking of a revolution in ideas. He said, the revolution which began in the last war, which has been the driving force of every significant political movement in the last 20 years, was a revolution against the predominant ideas of the 19th century, that is, liberal democracy, national self-determination, and laissez-faire economics. And so he's repeating this theme that we've talked about before, and it's also the theme that the fascists of Hayek's day, Mussolini and Hitler and others, understood. They attacked the ideas of classical liberalism. And so it was the demise of classical liberalism. And so once those ideas were thrown aside or marginalized, we had an enormous outburst of totalitarian government in the United States during World War I. And here's a short quote from the article that I put on the chat by Robert Higgs, War and Leviathan in the 20th Century, about some of the things that went on in the United States during World War I. Higgs writes that the government virtually nationalized the ocean shipping industry. It did nationalize the railroad, telephone, telegraph, and international telegraphic cable industries. It became deeply engaged in manipulating labor management relations, security sales, agricultural production and marketing, the distribution of coal and oil, international commerce, and the market for raw materials and manufactured products. Its Liberty Bond Drive dominated financial capital markets. It turned the newly created Fed into a powerful engine of monetary inflation, and it did double the price level in a couple of years. In view of the more than 5,000 government agencies of various sorts created, boards, committees, corporations, and administrations, contemporaries who describe the government's creation, excuse me, as war socialism were well justified, says Robert Higgs. So we adopted war socialism. Other things that happened during World War I, once the seeds were planted to disavow classical liberal ideas, Higgs writes that, yeah, it was open season on civil liberties. To read another short quotation, he said, there were criminal penalties on all forms of expression in any way critical of the government, its symbols, or its mobilization of resources for war under the Espionage Act of 1917. Now, the government censored all printed materials. It deported hundreds of aliens without due process. And it encouraged state and local governments and vigilante groups to conduct warrantless searches and seizures, blanket arrests of suspected draft evaders, and other outrages too numerous to catalog. In California, the author Upton Sinclair was arrested for reading the Bill of Rights in public. Okay, in New Jersey, The police arrested a man named Roger Baldwin for publicly reading the Constitution, and the Sedition Act that was passed led to the arrest of anybody who was thought to be discouraging enlistment in the Army. And there was even, Higgs writes about public hysteria that led to the lynching of persons suspected of disloyalty or not supporting the war. Lynching is murder by hanging. And so this is what Hayek is talking about here. Step one, the abandonment of classical liberal ideas. Step two, using war as an excuse for the adoption of complete totalitarianism in the United States during World War I. And that did happen. He also quotes some historians of his day who sound a lot like the neocons of our day. He quotes one man named Carr as saying, "War gives us a sense of meaning and purpose in life." That's on page 200, according to a Professor Carr. I've read almost the exact same words from some of the pro-war neocons in the United States is saying this. But of course, if you study economics, you know that, well, you know, what markets are is peaceful, voluntary, cooperative exchange and trade between consenting adults. But war is exactly the opposite. War is not not mutually advantageous like markets. War is death and destruction and anarchy. And that is certainly not the natural state of human beings. But this idea keeps popping up over the decades. War gives us a sense of meaning and purpose in life. This is similar to the quote that I read to you, I think, last week by Ayn Rand, who, commenting on so-called national service proposals, said that the hidden assumption behind all such proposals to bring back some sort of civilian draft is that living your life as a purposeful human being who pursues a career, starts a business, raises a family, is a waste. But making yourself a sacrificial lamb for the state is not. That's meritorious. And we keep running across this idea in some form, for decade after decade after decade. And this was in Europe in Hayek's day, but we see the same kind of language today in the United States. He also talks about the inevitability argument, and where of the socialists and people in favor of a planned society, they try to argue that it's inevitable. Give up, and so give up arguing, give up trying to stop it. It's inevitable, and they try to make the idea prevalent that we should be obedient to scientific laws. That there's this inexorable march toward a planned economy, a government planned economy. And so the idea is, well, why oppose it? It's inevitable, it's going to happen no matter what you say. Hayek, of course, does not believe that. And he says that the purpose is that we will be obedient to scientific laws and is intended to dismiss the role of liberty and human action by individuals. So our behavior can change the course of history. It's not hardwired in society in any way, is the argument he's making. And of course, you can pinpoint many individuals throughout history who have made a big difference, or groups of individuals who have made a big difference in things. The classical liberals of Europe created the intellectual atmosphere under which freedom and free enterprise could prosper, for example. It happened once, it could happen again. Hayek also starts talking about monopoly, as he has before in The Road to Serfdom. And in particular, he focuses on what are called so-called natural monopolies. And he's talking here about, in his day, the advocates of government planning were all advocates of having the government set up monopolies in such industries as electric power, natural gas, water supply, things of that sort, and then regulating them, regulating the price of them, and also other aspects of these industries, investment and so forth. But he points out the historical fact that these industries did not become monopolies by themselves. The free market did not create monopolies in the so-called public utilities. It was government that created monopolies. And so, they invented this phrase, public utility. But of course, if the public has a use for some product, It's a public utility. If I have a use for ice cream cones, well then ice cream cones are a public utility. They provide utility or usefulness to me, and I'm a member of the public. A good pair of shoes is a public utility. I'm part of the public. I enjoy wearing good, comfortable shoes. Therefore, they provide me with utility. Shoe salesmen are in a public utility business. And so this word public utility was invented to make a bogus distinction between things that are useful to us and things that the government wanted to create as monopolies and control for whatever reasons. And as Rothbard wrote in one of his Anatomy of the State article, I believe it was that governments always try to control the commanding heights, which include electric power, which include telecommunications, public education, the highways, the ports, and the seacoasts. Those are the commanding heights of society. And this also includes water supply, electricity, telephone services, and so forth. And so they used this the scare tactic of monopoly, which was not occurring, by the way. There was vigorous competition in the late 19th, early 20th century in these fields to grab hold of a monopoly control of these industries through so-called public utility regulation. And a lot of the so-called utilities remained privately run and owned by stockholders, but they were regulated by government. So that the government, and of course in the wars, in World War I, government nationalized the telephone industry in the United States and quite a few other industries. And so once the precedent has been set that the government can step in and control and regulate an industry, then I guess we've given up the ghost on whether or not the government can someday just take it over under the guise of a wartime emergency. And that's what happened in the United States in World War I. He returns to the knowledge problem again in Chapter 14, and he points out that, you know, when it comes down to it, the only real alternative to relying on the spontaneous order of markets is what he says is the uncontrollable and therefore arbitrary power of other men. And he means government regulators, government bureaucrats, government planners. And this is the path to the destruction of civilization. Freedom cannot be reconciled with government planning, he says. So once you go down that road and agree to some degree of government planning, you really are on the road to destroying society because of the inevitable screw-ups and counterproductive measures taken by all the planners, which we've talked about throughout this course. He talks about Hayek does the prospects for international order, but I want to recommend say something about one other article that I did put on the chat with tonight's class, and this article is the one by Murray Rothbard called World War One as Fulfillment, Power in the Intellectuals. And Hayek sort of hints around the material that's in here, although this was written long after Hayek wrote The Road to Serfdom. But Hayek must have known about this, that in the United States, the so-called progressives of the last few years of the 19th century and the first couple of decades of the 20th century were dominated by a religious point of view that was known as pietism. These are people who believed that in order for them to be saved and go to heaven, they had to first create a 1,000-year kingdom of God on earth. And in order to do that, they must eradicate all sin. And sin 50 years earlier included slavery, but that was long gone. And so the new type of sin was the consumption of alcohol and the Catholic Church. Rum and Romanism was part of their rallying cry. These are things that they were against, rum and Romanism. And so they believed that government could and should be employed to create heaven on earth. These were the people behind alcohol prohibition. They were in favor of discriminating against the Catholic Church because they were Protestants. And this was a part of the public school movement too. The founding fathers of the public school movement in America many of them were, like John Dewey, were pietists, and they wanted the public schools to force all American school children into one form of schooling where they could all be turned into good little Protestant pietists. And they were terrified at the influx of Catholic immigrants from Germany and Ireland and Italy and places of that sort in Europe. And so that was the beginning of this. And so not only did they believe that heaven on earth through government could be achieved in the United States, but also worldwide, it struck them that, well, how can we have a kingdom of God on earth if we don't eradicate sin on all the earth, not just the United States, but all the earth? And so this was a very powerful influence in the ideas that led to U.S. intervention in World War I to sort of remake Europe in the image of essentially the New England Yankees of Civil War fame. And that's essentially who most of these people were. Most of them were New Englanders. They were sort of neo-Puritans. And they had this compulsion to remake the entire world in their own personal image. And so they gave a lot of the intellectual support to Woodrow Wilson and his entrance into World War I, although none of them volunteered for the army. They all exempted themselves. They all had excuses for themselves of why they should not participate. And this included such people as John Dewey, Walter Lippmann, Irving Fisher, the economist, Herbert Crowley, the founder of The Nation magazine, Richard T. Ely, the founder of the American Economic Association, was one of these. And so some of the prominent people of the late 19th, early 20th century in the intellectual world were post-millennialists or pietists. And they gave a lot of intellectual weight. They added intellectual weight to this movement for worldwide government planning. And Hayek is talking about these things in The Road to Serfdom, although not in nearly the detail of Rothbard does. Okay, and he does, in chapter 15, Hayek does talk about the relationship between free trade and war. And there was this, and he's referring to an old slogan that was popularized by Friedrich Bastiat in the mid-19th century. And the slogan is, if goods cannot cross borders, armies will. He was talking about the fact that when people trade with one another and engage in peaceful international trade and commerce, they become familiar with each other, they rely on each other, they prosper together, they realize that this is a good thing to have a relationship with people in other countries, and they become friends with a lot of people in other countries, not just business associates, and they become more familiar with people from other countries and the cultures of other countries by doing business there. And as a result, the incentive or the opportunity for war is greatly diminished through free international trade. It's not abolished. There always have been wars, human beings being what they are. But this was an essential part of classical liberalism, classical liberal thinking, that free international trade is the deterrent to war. And the opposite is also true. Autarky, spelled A-U-T-A-R-K-Y, has always been an impetus toward war. This was the economic policy of Nazi Germany, autarky, or economic self-sufficiency. They wanted to be self-sufficient in everything and to produce all their food, clothing, shelter, and everything else within Germany. But the problem was Germany was not nearly as resource-rich as it would have had to have been in order to be economically self-sufficient in everything. Therefore, it needed to invade Poland and France and England and all these other countries, Russia, in order to steal their resources to achieve autarky. And so the movement toward autarky and against free international trade in the early part of the 20th century was a major reason for war, in Hayek's view. And this is not just Hayek's view. This is the view of many other classical liberals. It was the view of von Mises. It was the view of Friedrich Bastiat long before von Mises. Bastiat died in 1850, by the way. And so this is a very old idea, but that doesn't mean it's a bad idea. And so he also makes the case that, you know, we've seen Hayek's case against planning, the knowledge problem. I recommended that you all read the famous essay, I, Pencil, by Leonard Reed, that explains the enormous amount of decentralized information that is required just to produce something as simple as a pencil. And so it would be ludicrous to believe that the government could do a good job in planning the production of pencils, let alone a much more sophisticated society. And then it's even more ludicrous to think that international planning could work, because it involves an even more mind-boggling amount of information that would have to be utilized in order to plan a world economy. And so Hayek is making this point because in his day, there was, as in our day, there was a lot of talk about some version of one world government, or at least giving broad economic planning powers to the United Nations, or some version of the United Nations. And so he pinpoints how absurd it is. And it sort of reminded me, rereading this, of the European Union. And because, you know, the whole idea behind why it is that Europe over the centuries became prosperous and free after feudalism, at least, much more prosperous and much freer, was that it started out with hundreds and hundreds of city-states, independent city-states, although the trend over several hundred years was in the direction of consolidation and centralization of government that has given us the map of Europe that we see today. But with hundreds of city-states, if people lived under an oppressive government, they could very easily just move, vote with their feet, so to speak, to a less oppressive government. And this forced the politicians to be less oppressive, to tax less, regulate less, plan less, control your life less, because you had the ability to secede, to leave. And so that gave rise to freedom and prosperity in Europe. And so, and this was also what led to the idea in the minds of the American founding fathers of adopting federalism, putting most of the government power, such as it was in those days, in the hands of the state and local governments. You know, if we were to have government, the thinking was most of what it does should be state and local, because the closer to the people government is, the easier it is to control. And of course, the impetus to escape control of government, by government officials, is always first and foremost on their mind. That's why we've seen centralization and consolidation for hundreds of years, because the politicians know it's much more difficult for the citizens to control a highly centralized bureaucracy than it is to control the local town's mayor or the village mayor in a decentralized system. And so that was the idea behind federalism. And so when the European Union was created on the heels of the utter collapse of the Soviet Union, it was sort of trying to fight against history and reality. They were saying, we can make international planning work after all. But what we're seeing in Europe today is the collapse of the EU and the collapse of the European welfare states, complete with riots and the drying up of treasuries, public treasuries, and the threats of doing away with public pensions. And we'll be seeing that in the United States sometime very soon also, I think. And so Hayek, here he is in 1943, warning about the problems of this type of thing, of some sort of centralized governing body. And we did get it with the European Union. He was also quite astute in terms of the politics of such a thing. If we did set up something like the European Union, he is saying that the wealthier nations will use this system, this political system, to their advantage by plundering the less wealthy countries. And that is what has happened in Europe. And that's what happened whenever there's some kind of international agreement. And of course, the United States is the big 5,000 pound gorilla in the room with regard to this, using not only its financial weight over the years, but its military might as a threat source to force people to do what we want to do, want them to do. And so it's the language of these international agreements, international bodies like the EU might sound kind of nice, but of course political reality is that there will be coalitions of governments, probably most likely the wealthier ones, who will use this structure, this governmental structure, to plunder the less wealthy and the less powerful. And speaking of the EU, you know, one of the part of the impetus for the EU was to eliminate tax competition and regulation competition between European countries. If, say, Ireland decided to become a low-tax state with modest government regulation of business, and business all started migrating to Ireland at the expense of England and France and Germany, well, then England and France and Germany aren't going to like that. So the idea behind the EU was to try to homogenize the tax systems and the regulatory regimes of the European countries to eliminate competition. Once again, governments always do whatever they can to isolate themselves from pressure by the voters. And that's called democracy. Okay. Quebec does depend on some kind of international authority for maintaining law and order. I guess he had in mind these United Nations guys with the blue helmets. And, well, we've had those for many years, but they certainly have not done a very good job of maintaining law and order anywhere. And so that was one thing Hayek writes about in The Road to Serfdom that really hasn't worked out at all in any way. And then he does, at the very end there, he makes a great defense of small nations with the understanding that representative democracy under a constitutional system really is only meaningful in a relatively small society. In a country as big as the United States, for example, it's a farce. Let's see, here's what he says. Where the scope of the political measures becomes so large that the necessary knowledge is almost exclusively possessed by the bureaucracy, the creative impulses of the private individual must flag. I believe that here the experience of the small countries like Holland and Switzerland contains much from which even the most fortunate larger countries like Great Britain can learn. We shall all be the gainers if we can create a world fit for small states to live in. And so he was being quite prescient at that time, because the whole trend of the world was for governmental consolidation with the Soviet Union and the American Empire and the European Union being created later. But we only see people exercising their rights as individuals and having a high degree of freedom, Hayek is saying, in the relatively smaller states. That's what we see it. I see it the most, like Switzerland and Holland of his day, is what he pointed out. And that's a very important point, I think, that he makes here. Okay. He makes one what I call I did my notes here, this kind of a silly statement, where Hayek says, an international authority which effectively limits the powers of the state over the individuals will be one of the best safeguards of peace. So he does come out in favor of some kind of international authority that would limit the powers of the state. And, you know, it's easy to talk about this with, 60, 70 years of retrospect. To look at this and say this was a foolish thing to say, which it was, but it certainly has not worked out that we have an international body that protects the citizens from the state. It's sort of reminiscent of how a lot of people still believe that the system of checks and balances in the United States Constitution with the three branches of government is a check on the tyranny of the state. But of course, the way it has turned out is that the three branches conspire with one another. They collude with one another against the people. The Supreme Court, for example, rubber stamps just about everything the legislature does or the president. The president in the United States can lob bombs at any country in the world. They reserve the right to murder any individual, even on American soil, with drones and so forth. And none of this is constitutional. By any stretch of anyone's imagination. And so this is what the road that we've gone down on. And so the checks and balances are a fable. They don't check anything. and Hayek's discussion of these international bodies is reminiscent of that to me. It's that he had sort of a naive hope that this could happen, but it's more likely that an international body would be used to solidify the power of the state against the people. The politicians who run these bodies will use them to monopolize their power even more than it is now. The power over us, over the people, and to homogenize taxes, to make it difficult to escape taxes, to make it more difficult to escape regulation, and so forth. That's exactly what the EU has done. And hopefully it will die a quick death before our lifetimes are over. And so I guess I'll end there in my discussion of the last couple of chapters of The Road to Serfdom. And I'll take a look at the chat here and see if the people who are participating tonight, we're kind of a small class, have any questions. There's no requirement to ask questions. Okay, I guess not. I guess we only have, I think, 8 out of 37 students sitting in right at the moment. And so, Wes, I can always rely on Wes to ask a question. Wes asked me if there's a check and balance approach that appeals to me. Well, secession of both individuals and communities is a check and balance, a balance system that appeals to me. But only secession. Nullification too. If a group of citizens in a state or several states want to nullify federal laws and say we will not enforce them within our borders, that's a good thing. Okay, well, I guess I will make up another exam for the final exam for those of you who would like to get a grade for the course. So I guess I'll probably get it done tomorrow or the next day and send it on to Danny, so you'll be hearing from the Mises Institute, and so you'll be able to do it over the weekend, I would think. And so thank you all for participating once again. I hope you learned something. I hope you learned a lot about from reading The Road to Serfdom and some of the lessons that we can draw from it for today. And have a great night or morning, depending on what part of the world you're sitting in.